Arusa Radio offers. In Josie's Bible, an audio drama featuring some of the poetry of James J. Metcalf.
There are boxes in my attic garage that have been there since we moved here more than 20 years ago. Boxes that have remained unopened and untouched. We decided that now was the time to clear things out. Reduce the unnecessary and the unwanted. In one of those boxes, I found my mother's Bible. The cover was coming off and the binding was worn. I decided to bring it inside and keep it in my office. Last week, I gave it a closer inspection. Inside the now nearly unattached cover, I found a poem glued to the page. It was a poem cut out from a newspaper. The date at the bottom of the clipping was 1954. 1954 was a particularly difficult year for my mother. It began with the death of her own mother, Elizabeth. It had grown in anguish with the forced incarceration of my mother's older brother, Arthur, into a provincial care home for the insane. He had lived in our home after his discharge in 1952 from his first incarceration there, but he had become increasingly violent, harming our family dog and a deliveryman who brought goods to our home. Then, in April, my mother's older sister Theodora was hospitalized with a hysterectomy. Unfortunately, my aunt's condition took a turn for the worse and she had to spend nearly 6 weeks in hospital. Finally, in October 1954, my older brother, Jeffrey, was hospitalized with bulbospinal poliomyelitis, polio. He would spend nearly a year in an iron lung, and then the rest of his life with a deformed right leg. 1954 was also when my father left his position as an electrician for the Provincial Rural Electrification Agency and began his career selling life insurance. What had been a steady and secure income transitioned to one that was insecure, sporadic, and, initially, meager. My mother often worried about our family finances. She especially feared that we might lose our comfortable brick home in Sussex Nelson, that we might be thrown onto the public dole. Still, my mother was not a religious woman. We were British expats living in British Columbia, so we were nominally Anglican. I remember always attending Christmas communion. Of course, I always had a nice, new dress and hat for Easter services. We attended family christenings and funerals. But, to be truthful, I never saw my mother read her Bible. I remember no family discussions about religious issues. We seldom attended Sunday services. Religion was largely ceremonial, something we were expected to do. So, even though 1954 was a time of considerable anxiety for my mother, I was, nonetheless, quite surprised to find a very religious poem pasted inside my mother's Bible. It revealed an aspect of her that I never knew. The newspaper poem inside my mother's Bible read,
"From Portraits by James J. Metcalf. To bear my cross, I turn to you, Almighty God. In this my time of grief, I do not beg for comfort, I do not seek relief, I only seek the courage and the strength to bear my sorrow, that I may fulfill my place and carry on tomorrow. I do not want to drop my cross or fall beside the way. Just give me the grace to serve you, God, for still another day. Let not my body be broken, let not my mind grow weary. However much the skies may seem more dark and dreary, enable me to do your will, however great my loss, and as your humble servant, O God, to bear whatever cross."
My efforts in reducing the unnecessary and the unwanted stimulated a similar interest in my older brother, Jeffrey. His Ottawa attic yielded yet another surprise. He called me and said that he had uncovered our mother's diary. He shipped it to me by FedEx. For a number of years, my mother, Josephine Pettersley Burns, kept a diary. She had an eye gifted for details. Every diary entry included many interesting and revealing observations. It was a joy to read through it. She had come from Lincolnshire, England as a young child, just weeks after the end of the First War. She saw Vancouver grow from a tiny urban speck amidst the great swaths of fir, cedar and spruce forests to become Canada's great West Coast city. She married my father, Jack Burns, just weeks before his brigade of Royal Marines shipped out to the Burma Theater. Many of her diary entries were about her hopes and her love for him. During the war, she found employment as a shipping officer, generating and maintaining ships' manifests before they sailed from Vancouver Harbor. Her diary has many entries about the men she worked with, their foibles and peculiarities. As I read through her diary, I noticed that she stopped writing in it in March 1948. I believe I can explain that. That was when my youngest brother, Jack Jr., was born. I was still a toddler in 1948. There were only 16 months between me and my younger brother. So, she was very busy with child-rearing activities. Probably too busy to write in her diary. That was also when my family lived in Lake Penisk, which back then was a lumber mill town. The giant sawmill had electricity because it had its own steam plant, but the houses a mile away did not. Our house was really a lumber cabin, it had no electricity. Only wood heat and kerosene lanterns. She had to use a finicky hand pump to provide water. She was too busy to write in a diary. We were there because my father then worked for the Provincial Rural Electrification Agency, which was in the process of bringing electricity to the rural portions of the province. Our lives improved considerably when my father was reassigned to work as an electrical lineman in Sussex Nelson, just outside Vancouver. I have already shared that my father eventually switched careers, moving to selling life insurance during the summer of 1954. My mother began writing in her diary again in 1954, the most depressing year of her life. I found that she stopped writing in it about September 1955. I could find no entries after that date. When I searched the blank pages after her last entry, I found a handwritten thank you note addressed to my wonderful and caring friend, Beverly. In the thank you note, my mother had said she especially appreciated the poem that Beverly had given her. She said she had it glued into her Bible. However, when I inspected the envelope in which she had sent the thank you note, I noticed that it had been stamped, undeliverable, wrong address. My mother had attempted to send Mrs. Beverly Cayley a thank you note, but because the address was wrong, it had been undeliverable. However, the name Cayley was one I recognized. My younger brother had, while in high school, dated Marilyn Cayley. I decided to undertake an investigation. I was seeking Marilyn Cayley or one of her four siblings. I wanted to ensure that my mother's, very belated, thank you note actually reached the Cayley family. I doubt that I would have had success in 1955. There were phone books, but few other research tools. However, this is 2021 and finding people is relatively easy. In my very first internet search, I found Marilyn Cayley Showers. Bless those hyphenated last names. Marilyn Cayley Showers operated a storyboard business. Her website featured a 3-minute, animated video explaining what storyboarding was and how it could enhance the media development process. Her business was in Redondo Beach, California. Her list of clients included many major Hollywood producers. She was, as they say, in the business. What we now call storyboarding is often attributed to the Disney animation studios from the 1940s. Before storyboarding came to be standard practice in filmmaking, making a film began with only a written script. It was entirely up to the director to turn words on a page into visual images on the screen. For producers like Walt Disney, and, later, infamously Alfred Hitchcock, that was too unstructured of a process. Disney, as a visual artist, began drawing little pictures about what a scene or a shot should look like. Someone, we don't know who, decided to organize these little pictures into something like a comic book and then post it onto a bulletin board so everyone could see where things were supposed to go. For perfectionists, like Alfred Hitchcock or Walt Disney, storyboards gave careful control of every aspect of a project. Everyone could see exactly what the shot was supposed to look like and how it fit with other shots. Eventually, storyboarding became an engaging group process for creating a wide variety of media. It is used in authoring original content. It is also used to establish possibilities about how a particular shot can be made. It gives directors, producers, and the various artists an opportunity to do a test run. To envision how things might turn out. It is easy to move around pictures. Much harder to create alternatives with real sets, props, and actors. Excuse the digression. I connected with Marilyn Kaylee Showers through her business. I flew down and was able to spend a weekend with her at her home. I promised her that we would not talk about my brother. Marilyn was more than pleased to receive my mother's belated thank you note. I showed her my mother's Bible with the poem glued inside the cover. She read the poem and smiled. Her response surprised me. She said, "Yellow. Yellow?" I asked.
"Yes. Yellow. My mother, Beverly, color-coded her collection of poems. Poems on a yellow card meant that the card was for bereavement, personal grief."
I still did not understand.
"Come with me. We're going over to my son's storage locker. I have something to show you." My son is a wildlife photographer. Most of the time he is overseas in some wilderness, shooting video of various animals. This time he is in Borneo filming the proboscis monkey. He is not scheduled to be back home until after Christmas. He is away so much. And as you could see, my house is not very big. So, I keep most of his stuff here. I also keep things for my mother.
She opened the metal door and showed me a cabinet with boxes and boxes of poems. Each poem was taped to its own 5x7 colored index card, and each poem was carefully filed in a small, cardboard filing box.
My mother was a very organized person. Each day, she would cut a poem out of the newspaper, and then tape it onto an index card. Different colored index cards meant different things.
I pulled a poem taped to a green index card.
"See, you just pulled one that she classified as humorous. Read it and see if you'll agree."
The poem was called "The Stingy Man." Beverly Kaylee had written a date on the index card. June 14, 1952. She had also written the words by James J. Metcalf.
Stingy Man. Stingy Man. The stingy man is one who saves beyond the rainy day, and far beyond the point where he has any time to play. He is the one who never wants to spend a cent at all, not even once to entertain the friends who come to call. He lets you buy his coffee and his daily dinner too, but he will never use his purse to do the same for you. He always claims that he is broke, when in reality, he merely wants to gather up whatever goods are free. And while he may enjoy the things he gets from day to day, he never knows the greater joy of giving them away. James J. Metcalf, 1952.
Yes, I could see his humor. I could also see how he had transitioned to a religious theme.
My mother gathered poems from the newspaper practically every day from 1944 to 1960. I once did the arithmetic. That would be over 5,800 poems. She always attached them to a colored index card and then filed the card into one of the cardboard file boxes. Whenever my mother saw that someone had a need, she would send them a specially selected poem. She would always wrap it as if it were a special birthday gift.
When Beverly Kaylee saw that someone had a need, she would send them a specially selected poem. She would always wrap it as if it were a special birthday gift. Marilyn said that she had probably given away several hundred poems. Then, in the 1960s, Beverly Cayley stopped giving people poems from the newspaper. Later that night on Marilyn's small deck, drinking a glass of Chablis, I asked her why her mother had stopped giving people poems.
"Well, I have to admit that my siblings and I had something to do with it. To us, giving someone a poem cut from a newspaper seemed chintzy. Not appropriate. Instead, we encouraged her to buy greeting cards and send them instead. I remember saying that if she wanted to send a positive message to a friend or a neighbor whom she cherished, it was worth $1.25 to purchase a greeting card. Eventually, she agreed. But, for her own reasons, she kept her collection of newspaper poems. When she passed, I decided that I would keep her collection. Ever so often, I go over to the storage locker and read some.
I asked Marilyn how her mother got started collecting newspaper poems.
"What started my mother was one poem. One that she found in July 1944. I've got it framed. I'll be back in a couple of minutes."
Marilyn left and went to her office.
This really spoke to my mother. Remember, my father, Sergeant Richard Cayley, was with the Canadian forces participating in the D-Day invasion of France. My mother knew he was under enemy fire, but she knew little else. She found this poem and then she bought as many copies of the newspaper with the poem in it as she could. She gave copies of that poem to the other women she knew whose husbands and sweethearts were participating in the invasion.
Soldier's Prayer. Dear God, I need your help to do my duty in this war, to win the kind of peace that will endure forevermore. Give me the strength to use my gun with steady aim and true, and guide me in all other things a soldier has to do. Let not my eyes grow weary now, let not my stomach ache, and if the going gets too tough, let not my spirit break. My God, watch over all whom I love while I am over here. See that they never are in want, or have a single fear. And when the air is still once more, and we no longer roam, I pray that I may be among the soldiers going home. James J. Metcalf, 1944.
That started her off. After that, she collected poems and gave them away whenever someone's knee touched her heart.
So it was that Beverly Cayley gave my mother Josie Pettersley Burns the poem that I found in my mother's Bible. Mystery solved. Over a second glass of Chablis, Marilyn and I mused over how different times were then. How different from today. First, my mother was far from offended by receiving a newspaper clipping as a gift. She appreciated it. Indeed, she cherished it. She valued the thoughtfulness with which it had been given. Neither of us could see the same attitude today. Homemade gifts are seldom appreciated. We tolerate them from our nieces and grandchildren, but not from a mature professional woman, a woman we call a friend. A newspaper clipping taped to an index card would not be valued. It would be on par with the many throwaway advertisements we receive each day in the mail. Second, we would be fearful that if we transferred the poem to another medium, say placing it on our laptops as a home screen image, we had somehow violated the all-too-sacred provisions of copyright laws. Marilyn shared that she could never participate in any media project without signing multiple non-disclosure agreements. The words that are at the bottom of the poem in my other's Bible, all rights reserved, would terrify any potential collector. We also noted that in the 1940s and 50s, people could take inspiration from something they read. Of course, today no one reads. Even if they do read, reading is often cursory for information. If they seek emotional connection with a media experience, it comes from something visual, something animated. It is nearly always something they see, usually a video or a film. It nearly always has music and drama. Commitment and inspiration come from being immersed into an experience, from being there. As filmmakers often say, reading something, especially something as one-dimensional as a poem printed on newsprint, would not create an experience that folks today would value, respond to, one that would shape their feelings and perceptions. In a word, Beverly Cayley's collection of poems would be too blah, no zing, no grabber, just blah. When my visit was ending and Marilyn was readying to take me to the airport, she said that we had one stop to make. She drove me back to her son's storage locker up and selected one poem from the boxes. She handed it to me.
Consider this a special gift from me.
I placed it in my briefcase and gave her a hug. At the airport, as I exited her car, she said,
"Text me when you get there, so I'll know you are safe.
Text me when you get there, so I'll know you are safe. Text me." Of course, that is how we communicate today. We need to know in real time. We need to know right now. We do not need complete sentences or even whole words. Often, we simply use a symbol. There are many sequences of exchanges in which one symbol is answered with another symbol. Text me is very different from what Beverly Cayley did. She carefully selected a poem, wrapped it in an attractive package and then hand-delivered it to its intended recipient. Much more personal than a symbol in response to a symbol. Very different. In my office back at my house, I read the poem that Marilyn had given me.
Friends I Had, by James J. Metcalf. I used to have some special friends. I do not have today. And many times I wonder why. We had to drift away. I wrote them letters now and then. And some of them replied. Yet gradually and casually, the correspondence died. But every time I think of them and hold them in my heart, I wonder why they do not write and why we had to part.
I decided that copyright issues be damned. I made this poem my computer's home screen. Maybe that way, my new friendship with Marilyn won't just slip away. Thank you. One thing I learned during my visit to Maryland's was that in the 1950s, there were a number of poets who published their poems in the newspaper. It was a popular feature that most newspapers offered. I was particularly interested in the poet who had written the poem that my mother had placed in her Bible, James J. Metcalf. Again, I was lucky with my internet search. I found that Metcalf's daughter, Christina, had developed a website that included a biography of her father. Most of what I have learned about him has come from her biography. The peak of his popularity was during the early 1950s when his daily poems appeared in over 120 newspapers, including Canada's Daily Mail. He is believed to have published nearly 7,000 newspaper poems. During his lifetime, he published 16 books of his poems. Hallmark greeting cards had the exclusive rights to place his poetry into their greeting cards, and he was their most frequently published author. The terms of his contract with Hallmark have remained secret, but it is known that he was able to purchase a home in the Dallas suburbs with the proceeds from his Hallmark contract. One measure of his popularity is that the Chicago Sun-Times, which was his base of syndication, once said that James Metcalf was three times more popular than advice columnist Ann Landers, long said to be the most popular newspaper feature in America. Given his popularity in the 1950s, it is somewhat surprising that he is not today better known. I think that in part this is because he did little to create a cult of personality. His poetry was well known. He was not. During his lifetime, one of his most popular works was a poster that included one of his poems. The poem was entitled We Were the G-Men, and the text of the poem was surrounded by photos of 18 FBI agents from the Chicago FBI office, which was directed by Melvin Purvis. The poem included the lines, "We had to learn the hard way then the things we did not know, and as we took our chances great, we helped the Bureau grow." James Metcalf was one of the very first agents hired by Melvin Purvis. He served in the Bureau for almost a decade. In his later years, he loved telling stories about his time as an FBI agent in Chicago. He played an active role in the FBI operations against several well-known Midwestern gangsters, including Ma Barker, Pretty Boy Floyd, and, most infamously, John Dillinger. James Metcalf was part of the FBI team that assassinated Dillinger at Chicago's Biograph Theater. For a number of years, this poster was available for sale in the FBI gift shop at the Bureau's Washington, D.C. headquarters. In 1935, Metcalf left the FBI. The available biographies do not give a reason why. One speculation is that Metcalf was personally and professionally attached to Melvin Purvis. Metcalf was called one of Little Mel's boys, the agents that Purvis relied on the most. After J. Edgar Hoover forced Melvin Purvis to resign, a story for another occasion, Metcalf may have followed him with his own resignation. Even though neither still worked at the FBI, it is clear that Purvis and Metcalf remained close friends. In 1936, James Metcalf joined his brother as a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. While there, Melvin Purvis convinced the Metcalf brothers to go undercover and to spy on the activities of the German Bund societies that were supporting Hitler and were operating throughout the Midwest. The brothers' exposé of the activities of the Bund societies proved crucial in later efforts to prosecute members for their anti-US activities. It also produced a prestigious news reporting award for the Metcalf brothers. Then, in 1938, James Metcalf stopped working as a reporter. I could not find why, but I suspect that there may have been health issues. He moved his family to Southern California, and then, after the war, to Dallas, Texas. I could find no evidence that he either served in the military or worked in a defense-related activity during the war years. Given his strong patriotic tendencies, this is surprising. Again, I suspect health issues. Typically, he devoted several hours a day to writing poetry, often writing more than one poem a single day. He seldom felt the need to edit his previous work. The poems that we now see were largely spontaneous, one-draft creations. He took long, solitary walks. He said that most of his writing happened as he walked. As his fame grew, he hired a private secretary to handle the voluminous correspondence from his fans. He would give an occasional talk to a women's club or to a Lions Club meeting, but I could find no evidence that he either appeared on television or the radio. James J. Metcalf died suddenly and unexpectedly in March 1960. I mentioned that I had found Christina Metcalf's website dedicated to her father's work. I emailed her asking for additional details about her father and his work. I also asked her to recommend a couple of poems that would memorialize her father. My emails were returned with the error message, "Domain not found." 2 days later, I checked the website itself. It had been taken down. It was no longer active. Here are two of James J. Metcalf's poems that I have selected in his memory.
Good morning, God. Good morning, God. And thank you for the glory of the sun, and thank you for the health I have. To get my duty done, I shall devote the hours of this golden day to you, by honoring your holy name. In everything I do, I shall pursue my daily art, without complaining or fear, and spend my every effort to be friendly and sincere. I know there have been many days that I have whiled away, but this is one that I will try to make your special day. And so once more, good morning, God, and please depend on me, because I want to honor you for all eternity. James J. Metcalf, 1958. in memory of you. In memory of you. I hold you in my dreams at night, I call you in the dawn. And yet I have to tell myself that you are really gone, that you are gone beyond recall, forever and a day, and there is nothing I can do, and nothing I can say. You were so wonderful to me, so gentle, sweet, and kind. It seemed that I was always in your heart and in your mind. No, there is nothing I can say, except a loving prayer, that God will bless you, dearest one, and keep you in his care. And in my silent sorrow there is nothing I can do, except to live a better life, in memory of you. James J. Metcalf, 1959. In memory.
All selections of the poetry of James J. Metcalf taken from Wiki Creative Commons.
Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.